Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, the stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and today is the second edition in my Friday series, Clean Water Radio, focusing on Iowa's waters from streams to rivers to tap water faucet. Last week, we heard from activists and policy researchers advocating for regulation of farm operations, which contribute the vast majority of nutrients into Iowa's lakes and streams. This week, we will focus on groups who work with farmers to develop conservation strategies on their land. My guest and co-host for the whole hour is Dr. Jacqueline Comito, who does double duty as the co-manager of Iowa Learning Farms and is the director of a music-based educational program, Water Rocks. Iowa Learning Farms creates opportunities for farmer-to-farmer education on soil and water conservation techniques. Water Rocks, on the other hand, creates catchy, goofy songs and videos on conservation, mostly to share with young audience, but some of them, such as the one we're about to play, have caught on with farmers, too. Here's an example of Jackie's work with Water Rocks.
Do you ever feel the uncontrollable urge to disc your field? Do you experience a shortness of breath when thinking about long hours on the plow? Wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, thinking about the cost of diesel fuel? If so, you might have restless tillage syndrome, a common disease affecting many row crop farmers. To help control my symptoms, I started using no-till.
Possible side effects may include reduced soil erosion, a reduction in airborne particles, a decrease in input costs, and the reduction or elimination of carbon loss. While on no-till, farmers often experience an increase in profits while improving soil fertility and soil health. No-till land often sees an increase in infiltration, soil moisture, and organic matter. No-till can be combined with cover crops for maximum benefits. Before starting no-till, consult your extension agronomist or NRCS office to see if your land is healthy enough for agricultural activity.
Since starting no-till, I've had more time for what's really important. No-till worked great for me. Ask your local agronomist if no-till is right for you.
That was the work of Jacqueline, my guest, Jacqueline Comito, Dr. Jacqueline Comito, and her production team at Water Rocks. Welcome to the show, Jackie.
Thanks, Greta.
Well, that video that we heard is really just hilarious, I think.
Yeah, it was fun to do, and it's really hit home with a lot of the farmers who have seen it. In fact, they've been showing it at conferences ever since it came out. It's probably one of our top videos.
And we hear so much about the importance of water quality and conservation practices on farms, but usually it's pretty serious talk with overtones of morality. You need to do this, do the right thing, and that message. But what made you think of doing something so fun?
Well, people actually are more motivated when you do an emotional appeal and when you use humor. Humor goes a lot farther than being really serious. Yeah, these are critical issues, but we don't need to be so serious about them all the time. And so if you can get people to laugh together, I think that's one step to making change. And with youth, because this is a youth program, the more you can engage them with humor, the more they will sit up and pay attention.
Well, your background is in anthropology, so you, I guess, are naturally focused on the human side of these equations.
Yeah, actually, my background, before I got my PhD in anthropology, I got 2 degrees in theaters and arts and music. So I have a background in both, which explains perhaps Water Rocks a little bit better. But yeah, I mean, whether you're doing theater, you have to understand people. And then anthropology, you just naturally, my job has been to really get a handle on what motivates people, what might we be able to do to motivate them to change. And that's where, as I'm working with scientists and different engineers, they'll turn to me and say, okay, we need to understand this better, because it isn't just about creating that technical solution. It's then about getting the motivation for people to adopt it.
And we have on the line a farmer from Wright County on the Boone River watershed, northeast of Fort Dodge. So he's not quite in our listening range, but when I read an editorial he wrote for the newspaper, I really wanted him to share his story on the show. And I understand you, Jackie, are the one who encouraged him to write that editorial.
Yes, I did. Tim has been working with us for the last 2 or 3 years, and when you hear Tim talk and you hear him in just tell his story, it's pretty compelling, and so I thought it would be great if we could put that story in a way that could reach more people.
And when you say you're working with Tim, that's in your the other side of your job.
The Iowa Learning Farms, yeah.
Right, and that is farmer-to-farmer research, communication.
Yeah, the Iowa Learning Forum started with a pretty simple idea that if we got farmers talking to other farmers about conservation practices, would it make a difference? And we've actually shown it does. We have, from our field days, we farmers who attend our field days, we get those farmers to go talk to 50% more farmers. So for every field day, we get 50% more.
That's great. So Tim's story is really connected with that motivational factor, like you mentioned, and also with the theme of today's edition of Clean Water Radio on KHOI. Farmers have a huge role to play in the water quality of our river streams and lakes, and this is a lesson that caught Tim by surprise. Tim, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me on.
Great.
Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Jackie.
So you have a story to tell. Let's set the scene. You live in the Boone River watershed, and this was one of the watersheds that were targeted for management as part of the Mississippi River Basin Initiative to reduce nutrient outflow from the state and help control the size of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. You heard about some incentives that were being offered by this program. Is that correct?
Yes, in 2011, I was interested in some of the practices, and I decided to enroll in that program and learned a lot from it in doing so.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't catch the last word.
Tim just said he learned a lot by doing it, and I think wasn't the first thing that really struck you, Tim, was that there were actually a lot of nutrients coming off of your land.
Well, yes. Part of one of the practices is monitoring the tile water that flows from my farm into the stream that goes through my farm. And it was through that I realized the nitrate levels leaving my farm were higher, really, than they should be, according to the EPA levels. And that's what really opened my eys to some of these the need for doing some of these practices.
So the EPA levels are something like 10 parts per million, or?
Yes. In that first year, before I implemented any of the practices, my levels were actually higher than what the stream levels were, and I guess that's what really started to make me think, maybe there's some things I could be doing to improve that.
Hmm. So you were monitoring the tile, right, the outlet of the tile that drained your field.
One of the practices that I decided to do was install a wood chip bioreactor, and part of that process was to monitor the inflow of the water before it goes through the bioreactor and then also the outflow when it leaves the bioreactor. But before I had the bioreactor installed, we went ahead and started monitoring the tile water just to get a baseline to see what indeed the nitrate levels were.
Hey, Tim, how many acres does your bioreactor actually filter then or process?
There's approximately 30 to 40 acres. The farm is 400 acres, so obviously it doesn't filter all the water that goes through the farm, but it does help in those 30 or 40 acres, and the bioreactor will reduce nitrates by about 50%.
And I think our audience might not be quite aware of what a bioreactor is. Could you describe the size and shape of a bioreactor?
Sure. It's something that sits underground. It's connected to a tile line that flows into a stream, and mine is approximately 10 foot wide and about 110 feet long, and it's about 5 foot deep. The bottom of the bioreactor is just a little bit below the level of the tile line, and it's filled with wood chips, and then there's about 2 foot of soil put back over the top, and the water flows through that, and as it flows through, there's bacteria that will convert the nitrates, just nitrogen, and it's released through the soil rather than being put into the stream.
And these are bacteria that would normally be present in nature?
Yes, they're naturally occurring bacteria.
So in this whole process of, you know, deciding to install a bioreactor, you discovered that the water exiting your tile was a lot higher than you'd like and higher than the stream. What happened after the bioreactor was installed? Did you continue to monitor?
Yes. This program was for 3 years. It started in 2011, so last year was the last year of it. There were also some other practices that I incorporated on the farm, and which probably have as important or more importance in reducing nitrates. And probably the main one would be using a overwintering cover crop. And I utilize a cereal rye, and that's seeded with an airplane before I harvest my crops in the fall, probably in early September is typically when we seed the cover crops. And that's probably had the most benefit, I think, of helping to reduce the nitrates leaving my farm. What the cover crop does, it sequesters the nitrogen in the soil, and it goes into organic matter or carbon and keeps it back in the soil as it breaks down, as the plant breaks down later in the season. And the other 2 years of water monitoring, I've seen my nitrate levels actually decline slightly. What was interesting is the stream levels in both 2012 and 2013 were considerably higher. So as other farms in the watershed were probably contributing more, I realized using cover crops and my nitrogen timing, when I apply my nitrogen to the corn crop, actually were declining. So I could see the benefits right away by utilizing this water monitoring of my tile line.
Well, and Tim, cover crops also have that added benefit of going after phosphorus, using up some of the phosphorus and keeping that out of the our rivers and streams too. So cover crops give you that added, you know, an extra benefit that, for instance, bioreactors or wetlands perhaps wouldn't do. But the other thing is cover crops really keep your soil in place. So we're not having that soil erosion loss. And of course, you mentioned how it maintains soil health. So cover crops are a really great strategy to have on the land.
And when we consider the Iowa nutrient reduction strategy, the cover crop is probably one of the tools that will give the most bang for the buck, so to speak. As Jackie mentioned, the soil conservation aspects, the wildlife benefits, and the water quality benefits, there's really just a great amount of to be gained from using cover crops.
Hey, and Tim, let's not forget the aesthetics. Who doesn't like to see green growing out in November, right?
Well, it is a different picture when the countryside is brown and you have green out in your fields. And in terms of soil health, I think we fail to realize that in Iowa we only have something growing about 3 months of the year. But when we use cover crops, we can add another perhaps 2 or 3 months of a living crop growing out in the fields, and that's a great benefit to the soil health.
Tim, can I ask you, how has your bottom line been since you installed these practices?
Well, 2012 was a drought year. 2013 was a wet year and a dry year. 2014 looks to be a little better. It's, as far as yields are concerned, it's been hard to measure.
Right.
But in terms of long-term benefit, again, hard to measure. But I think as a farmer and as a landowner, those are very important goals for me, and to protect my soil from leaving the farm and also to protect the water that flows through my farm, I think are very important goals to have.
Tim is investing in the long term, in the next generation when you do things like this. We know from other research on research farms that have been able to look at cover crops over, you know, a considerable number of years, that when you start hitting the 10-year mark, you start to see those soil health improvements. So some of the benefits can't be quantified in the short term, but will certainly be quantified in the long term.
Right. I can imagine that with more organic matter in the soil, issues like drought and wet will be less severe.
Wouldn't you say, Tim, that cover crops give your fields a bit more of a resiliency to handle some of these extreme weather changes?
I would, because especially the last 2 years where we've seen such extreme rainfall events, where we've had 2 and 3 and 4 inches at a time over maybe a 2 or 3 week period, having that cover crop to protect the soil And I guess another practice that I'm doing is strip tillage, so I'm leaving more residue on the soil surface, and all these things combined just help protect this from water erosion. And I just think that's so important. And if our soil is not protected when those rainfall events come, there's nothing we can do. It's too late. Once the rain starts to fall and the soil starts to wash away, it's gone.
And I have to point out, Greta, that Tim actually is participating in I don't know, 3-4 different research projects right now. The strips, which is to incorporate prairie strips onto his farm, he's going to start that this fall, and he's participating with us on 2 different cover crop mixture studies that we're doing. So Tim is not just willing to do these practices, he's also willing to participate on that larger level and help do research.
Wow. And I think your story just has that kind of appeal, that farmer-to-farmer appeal that Jackie's talking about. It actually reminds me a little bit of the restless tillage syndrome that we started with, because, you know, you started out and you have a story where you were, you know, just an average farmer doing what you thought was good practices, the best practices, and it turned out, well, you weren't perfect. There was room to improve, and that's really hard for people to accept in all contexts.
Well, I think there's new, you know, there's new tools to use now, and I think it was time for me to step up, I guess, to the next level perhaps and try to incorporate some of these new tools on my farm. And there's such a great push from so many different organizations and agencies to try cover crops and to do different things to protect our water and to protect our soil. So I think it's very important to take advantage of these different opportunities.
Yeah, but Tim, that doesn't explain why you're then willing to go out and talk to other farmers. What motivates that?
I don't know. I guess I enjoy doing it. It's always about 5 minutes before the time to talk. I get a little nervous and wonder why I'm doing it, but once I get going, I guess I enjoy it. But farmers want to learn, I think. Farmers are great innovators. You know, if there's a problem to be solved, farmers can generally get that problem solved. And I think we're being faced with a problem today, and that being water quality. And I think that's something that we can do our part. And as more people do it, I think these problems will get solved.
Have you been able to encourage other farmers to get their water tested?
Well, I've mentioned it as I spoke at different meetings and so forth, and I've got some farmer friends that I've talked to about doing it, and there's some interest in it. I think there's a little, maybe perhaps, apprehension if they would have higher levels of nitrates that information might be used against them. We have a litigious society, and sometimes there's a concern about being, you know, a problem arising from that information, but in my case, having that information helped me to make a decision to do something different, and I think that's what would help a lot of other farmers if they decided to participate in this water monitoring.
The other thing that I know my work with farmers over the last 9 years shows that farmers that are engaging in conservation and using these new tools seem to actually be more enthusiastic about farming. Like there's a creativity there, and they seem to enjoy trying to problem solve once they really understand that there is a problem to be solved. Tim, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would, because I think it's a whole other set of things to try out and see what works, what doesn't work, and you know, it's a learning process for me. I wish I would have started it 20 years ago because I know a lot more about it now, but I'm still learning, and I guess that's an important thing.
It's a matter of getting the farmers to that point where they're willing to accept there's a problem and be curious enough to get involved.
Well, I think of another situation. It was probably about over 40 years ago when most farmers used a mobile plow. And as a result, in the springtime, when we'd get some strong winds, we'd have a lot of dust blowing, and there would be, you know, the fields would blow terribly. And gradually, farmers shifted away from the mobile plow and went to a disc chisel or a chisel system, leaving more residue on the surface of the soil, which really helped eliminate that dust blowing. And I think this nitrate question perhaps falls in that category, although nitrates are invisible, where dust blowing is something we see. But nevertheless, it's a problem, I think, that can be addressed.
Yeah, you told me that your dad was one of the early adopters of a chisel plow. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, when I've told the story at the meetings I participate in, that when my dad sold his Moldboard plow, the neighbor that bought it wondered how we were going to plow how we were going to farm without a Moldboard plow. And you know, we had a plan, and we had a way to accomplish that, but that was the mindset: we need to use a Moldboard plow. Well, we've learned since then that that's not the case. There are other ways to do tillage. There's ways to do less tillage, and even in the case of strip tillage, you know, even doing less tillage than that. And strip tillage is kind of a compromise between full tillage and no-till, but in the soils we have in north central Iowa, it's an important tool to use.
Great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say, you or Jackie, to ask Tim?
No, Tim, I just want to thank you for everything you're doing, especially going out and talking to other farmers. That is as important as making the changes on your land.
Well, I guess in my own case, I went to some meetings that Iowa Learning Farms sponsored and learned about strip tillage, and that's what really gave me the motivation and the encouragement, listening to other farmers that were doing that practice. So I realized how important it is, perhaps, to give back a little bit in that respect, just to tell other farmers about some things I'm doing.
And we know that it takes a couple of field days. You're not just going to go to one and suddenly say, oh, I'm going to change. It usually takes two or three field days. And so that's why one of the things Iowa Learning Farms and Practical Farmers of Iowa, we want to have as many field days out there across the state to give those farmers that opportunity to hear this information.
That's correct. I probably went to half a dozen different
There you
meetings.
Go, six. Yeah, probably.
Okay, well, Tim, thank you so much for joining our show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have your perspective.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, goodbye.
Bye.
That was Tim Smith, a farmer from Eagle Grove in Wright County, which is located 30 miles northeast of Fort Dodge on the Boone River watershed. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. I'm with Dr. Jackie Comito from ISU Extension. And this is the second installment of a Friday series I'm calling Clean Water Radio. Today we are talking about the central role farmers play in cleaning up our waters and how different farm groups, including the Iowa Soybean Association, which we will hear from in the second half of the hour, are working with farmers to make that happen. And that would also include Iowa Learning Farms, the group that my special guest co-manages. Jackie, you mentioned that Tim participates in your programs. What do the programs look like? About how many farmers show up, et cetera?
Well, the Iowa Learning Farms is actually a pretty broad statewide program that does a multitude of things. Field days is one of them. In any given year, we will do anywhere from 25 to 30 different field days or workshops. And our farmer attendance averages maybe 50, 60 farmers at each one of those events. Sometimes we have over 100, sometimes maybe only 30. For us, it's less important the number, but the interest of the people who are in the room, depending on where you're at in the state. We also do a monthly webinar where we bring in a certain expert in a specific topic, and they will talk for about 20, do a present 25-minute presentation, and then take questions using Adobe Web. And then we do we did the Culture of Conservation video series. We do – actually, the one thing we do know based on some of the work done by sociologists such as Lois Wright Morton is that farmers will be influenced not just by other farmers but by their community members. So one of the things Learning Farms started doing in about 2009 was a really strong community outreach program too, because we felt like we needed to educate everybody in Iowa. So we built this thing we call the Conservation Station. We have three of them now, a Conservation Station fleet. And during the summer, we go to county fairs, we go to community events, and we talk soil and water to Iowans. And trust me, Iowans are really interested in this topic. So that's the Learning Farms. Then the other component we do is the research. And Tim is
participating in two research projects that we got as a part of grants we got from the USDA, the National Resource Conservation Service. They're called Conservation Innovation Grants. And we're studying – he talked about cover crops. Well, he was speaking of cereal rye. Well, this study is actually looking at what if we combine a couple of different plants, complementary plants, and will they work in Iowa? So we're looking at that along with our partnership with Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Well, that's neat. I love the idea of educating the community. It's really wonderful to be able to kind of read your landscape. I remember when I first started volunteering for the Soil and Water Conservation District in Johnson County, it just opened up my world to be able to look at the landscape and see what farmers are doing, you know, see when there was a conservation practice in place. Unfortunately, I didn't know any farmers. I didn't know who owned the land. I wasn't a long-term resident, so I couldn't, you know, comment to the farmer at church or anything, oh, great job you're doing. But I suppose that's kind of what you're pushing for.
Well, if you with our trailer, we have a rainfall simulator in the back that actually takes chunks of land right out of a field and then rains on it to show, simulates what happens, and we have several different land management choices. You can actually see, I think we have the video up on our Water Rocks YouTube channel, so you can actually see the rainfall simulator in action. And that is a really concrete example. I remember Matt Helmers, my co-manager on the Learning Farms, was standing there with a farmer, and we had 30% residue on the tray, and it was still eroding. And the farmer said, wow, I always thought that was enough, but I can see that it's not enough. And so maybe I need to increase the amount of residue I have on my land. So it influences farmers. It influences young people. One of the things, Water Rocks, the youth program, just naturally kind of came out of Learning Farms, that we understood that we needed to be reaching that next generation, help them understand Iowa, our agricultural practices, as well as our environment. So, yeah, education and really letting kids get their hands on things. And Water Rocks is a very hands-on, because along with the videos, we go out and do a good, like, 130 to 150 events every year.
Yeah, I've noted to myself that the popular education about farms is really behind the times. I mean, they usually show a guy in overalls with some chickens, some pigs, you know, it introduces certainly the different species that are involved in agricultural production, but it has absolutely no relation to the on-the-ground reality out there.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. We want them to understand. One educator told us that we were like the glue that brought agriculture and the environment together. I mean, the same is true from environmental education. Sometimes they just talk about the prairie as if the state of Iowa still has all these great prairies. Well, we don't actually have as many, or wetlands. So it's really helping us understand the world in which we live in, and then showing the beauty and the mystery of that world, and then inspiring youth to say, wow, we want to help not only keep it the way it is, but make it better, you know, improve it.
Well, we have some more work of yours, speaking of the youth work that you do, from the Water Rocks program. It is we're not going to do the cover crop. We're saving the cover crop anthem for last. That is the heavy metal piece that Jackie came up with. But this one coming up is a very delightful song for kids. I had to shorten it, so I'm going to narrate partway through what happens. But we can start off.
Charlie wagged his tail and asked if I knew, what does the river want to do?
I know I do, I know I do, I know I do, I know I do,
said the mighty eagle way up in a tree. I am here every day, I know what I see. It twists and turns left and right, twists and turns left and right. That's what the river
So that's the eagle eye view of what the river wants to do. And then the song goes on to describe what the beaver's eye view is, the river kind of up and down. And then the fish eye view of what the river does.
Twist and turn.
This is Clean Water Radio on KHOI Community Radio, and that song was a production of Water Rocks, which my special guest Jackie Comito directs along with her work at the Iowa Learning Farms. I love this particular video, and we will have a link to the YouTube channel that you have because it shows kids dancing, and certainly the song lends itself to that. It describes twisting and turning, wiggling and jiggling. Can you talk a little bit about the goals of the song?
Well, it's interesting because this song was inspired by a scientific presentation that I heard by Dr. Eisenhardt at Iowa State, where he was telling us, this was after some big flooding. He said, well, what does a river want to do? And I thought, well, what a great question. What does the river want to do and from whose perspective? And so the song was written from the different creatures that live around the river's perspective. But when you're doing youth education, if you can write a song that includes movement for kids, you've got a success. And repetition, because the kids echo, like when we go out and do this, we actually do this song with them when we go out and do education events. And so you can you sing it, they sing it with you, they get into it really quickly. It's an easy tune to pick up, and they love the movement. Kids love movement. So all of those things, you're engaging kids on many levels, and when you do that, they're going to have a better chance of remembering it. So the goals was to help them understand what a river wants to do. So when we're done with the song, we'll say, okay, what does a river want to do? And from whose perspective? And then nine times out of ten, they will be able to answer that question only having heard the song once.
And all of those messages are very important for our conservation. The twisting and turning is an issue. We often channelize our rivers.
Right. That's a big problem in Iowa, channelizing the rivers. And that was done a long time ago. So right. Restoring them to their meandering is important.
And then the beaver, from the beaver's perspective, of course, she's building a dam, and she sees how the water rises and lowers, you know, with the rainfall.
Right, which are natural phases of a river, the flooding and then the getting less water during August, September. Those are part of the natural things. They're getting rather dramatic in the state these days. The last 2 years where we saw no water in the rivers, it was almost depressing, wasn't it?
Yes.
But now when they're up high, they look scary. You almost think, wow, is that going to flood? But it's also nice to see the rivers flowing, at least for me.
Right,
It's nice to see the rivers flowing.
And, you know, going out to its banks, I understand that's where, you know, a lot of the reproduction happens.
Right.
And then the fish. Oh, the fish. They find fast parts and slow parts.
Right. And that's important, too. It's really important that rivers have – and that's where the channelization is such a problem. Because when you speed up the flow of the river, you're losing that meandering, and the meandering allowing for the slow and the fast. And that's actually part of the way rivers can actually help clean the water, too. I mean, it's an important part of the river to be able to go fast and slow. And when we just speed it up, it just sends everything just streamlining, basically, to the Mississippi and to the Gulf of Mexico.
That's fascinating, all of this. And I hear that you're putting together a couple of videos with youth this summer.
Yeah, we did a video called This Is Our Time, and we recorded it with a couple of really talented high school students, one from Southeast Polk, Emily Waskell, and one here from Ames, Noah Stevens, and they do some rapping, and then we have other young people singing the chorus and the refrain. And this song is really about the challenges that we're facing with climate change. These things are happening, and young people are noticing it. And what they're saying is, hey, this is happening, and it's for real, but don't worry because we can solve these problems. This is opportunity. This is our chance to show who we are and what we can do. So it's both an uplifting song, but it's also very clearly rooted in the problems that they're facing. The young people were great to work with. They helped us record in the recording studio, and then they came in and did the video. We did it late 80s, so they were dressed in, you know, like, remember the bright jumpsuits,
yeah,
pink and stuff. It was really funny to see these. We had, I don't know, I think we had like 16 high school students from Jewell, Ames, and Southeast Polk, or that would be Altoona. And we gelled the guy's hair, and they loved that. They were just, you know, give them a chance to get dressed up and be a little silly, and they had a blast. That should come out this fall. Josh LaVille is directing that and doing all the video work, and that'll be out in the fall. High school students in town have been great to work with. They love participating with Water Rocks. Particularly Ames High has been, you know, I know these kids, and you know, some of them grew up in my neighborhood, so it's an opportunity for them, and it's just a joy to get to work with them.
And your goal, of course, is to go viral.
Well, I don't know if the goal is to go viral per se. The goal is to get the right audience to be watching your videos. Having had a little experience with viral videos.
Yes, we won't mention that.
The one thing I learned is that sometimes.
Hooray!
Hooray for Ames. Sometimes when a video goes viral, a lot of people see it, but do they actually comprehend it? With Water Rocks, we wanted to reach the audience so that it's really, truly being absorbed and enjoyed. And so sometimes when it goes viral, that may not happen because then all the chatter gets in the way.
Right. Well, you mentioned environmental literacy, and actually a workshop that we had in radio was, oh, you have to make sure that your audience knows what you're talking about. And so, you know, like a mold board plow, you know, does everybody out there know what that is when Tim was talking about it? And well, of course, it's the one that is shaped sort of to turn the soil over, whereas a chisel plow, which was the alternative he was describing, digs it down. And or, you know, the word watershed is the example that our presenter used.
Yeah, watershed is one of those words for one of our culture of conservation video series. And we took a camera to the three major college campuses in the state and just stopped college students and other people who lived there and said, what's a watershed? Do you know what a watershed is? And most people could not tell us what a watershed was, and is what encouraged us that we really did need a youth education program. So that word watershed is one of the primary things that we teach, and we have a lot of creative ways to teach it, including we have a song saying we all live in a watershed that explains it.
Exactly.
But yeah, we didn't explain it now, so Greta, what's a watershed?
Well, okay, everybody does live in a watershed. It's a question of which watershed you live in. And I, for instance, live in the Skunk River watershed. The creek that is closest to my house that our land drains to is Indian Creek, and that leads into the Skunk River.
And Greta just said the key thing. It's an area of land that drains into a common water body.
Well, our next audio piece is from somebody who concerns himself with watersheds. He is Roger Wolf of the Iowa Soybean Association. The Iowa Soybean Association has an environmental program, and Roger does work with watersheds and also with farmers like Tim. In fact, Tim used the Iowa Soybean Association's water monitoring program to get started there with his discovery. I'm with Roger Wolf, the Director of Environmental Programs and Services at the Iowa Soybean Association. And Roger, I couldn't believe my ears when driving down the road, I heard a commercial on the radio from the Iowa Soybean Association talking about clean water. This was several weeks ago before I had done some research, and I thought, holy cow, a commodities organization in Iowa is talking about clean water. What is that all about?
Well, Greta, we really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and we're thrilled that you heard the public statement on water quality. The Iowa Soybean Association has actually been in the business of doing this for quite some time. You know, one of the things that often happens when we start telling people all the things that we do and all the farmers that we work with on natural resources and water quality, you know, folks often say, wow, we had no idea. And so what we're really trying to do in the last several years is really make a concerted investment to get the story out. Because a big part of our mission is representing soybean farmers. There's 40,000 soybean farmers in the state. And what we're about is trying to engage more farmers in the places that they farm on issues that are important to them. Natural resources, so our soil, water, the management of nutrients. This board that I work for, we work at the pleasure of 21 elected farmer leaders, have made a long-term commitment in natural resource management. The program here at ISA is about 14 years old. Over those 14 years, we've invested over $20 million on these issues.
When you say you've invested that money, is this mostly personnel, such as yourself? You're directing environmental programs. Mm-hmm. Presumably you have staff.
Yep. Well, we've built a program. When I started, it was one person working on these issues. And then we're investing in action-oriented programs that do a lot of monitoring, measurement, and analysis to help farmers make informed decisions on their farm. And those decisions deal with the soil, nutrient management. And we actually, in the mid-2000s, we started looking at energy use on the farm. And we do a lot of water monitoring. So in this building, we have a certified and accredited laboratory. And so we do all the analysis here in-house. We have a chemist on staff. I have environmental planners on staff. I have agronomists on staff, environmental specialists. So we're in the business of going out in the field and helping farmers work on soil, nutrient kinds of issues on their farms. But we also do this work in watersheds across the state as well.
I see. So there you might work with a watershed management board.
Absolutely. What we kind of pride ourselves in is we help give farmers kind of a leadership voice on these watershed boards and really try to facilitate comprehensive planning. So we'll use geographical information systems and analysis and assessment, and then really work with the farmers as a key stakeholder group to come up with plans that then lead to more programming, and it's a continuous improvement process.
Well, a lot of people are impatient with the progress that farmers have made. They see that we've had a voluntary system for a long time, and still there are, less than 50% of farmers spend anything on conservation, according to the Iowa Rural Life Poll. And how do you get that ball rolling a little faster?
Well, I push back just a hair on that because in some ways, you could define a voluntary system as anything goes. Kind of a willy-nilly process, and whatever you do is going to be okay. Well, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a significantly coordinated voluntary system, and for the most part, and so what I'm talking about is how do we understand the variability that exists in our landscape so that we make sure that practices that are targeted can actually perform. So I think there's kind of a disconnect in terms of what voluntary means. And I certainly understand the frustration. I've been working on these issues for 25 years. This has been my career. I worked in the soil conservation offices. That's where I started. And then got the opportunity to work in the private sector with the SAG organization. So what we're trying to do is really show that a voluntary approach can actually perform. And really what everybody should be interested in is what is the impacts of deploying these practices in the landscape. The last thing we want to do is tell farmers that you need to do this and then not see the result.
That's why you do the monitoring to...
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Tim Smith. He was on the program earlier, and he said that it was thanks to the Iowa Soybean Association that he got to test his water at various stages of implementing some new practices. I think it was a bioreactor right at the outlet of his tile and cover crop as well. So he said it was Iowa Soybean Association that did the testing for him.
Yeah, what we do in our programs is every farmer's unique, and we try to find ways to provide assistance. And Tim was interested in trying some different practices at the time. So one of the programs that came into the watershed that he farms in was the Mississippi River Basin Initiative. that's managed through the NRCS. And the way that program was structured is that he got more points if he did a combination of practices. So he signed up for cover crops, I think it was a nutrient management program, strip tillage, and then he put in this bioreactor, and then edge of field monitoring was the other practice. And so yes, we worked with Tim. We consulted on the installation of the bioreactor, and that particular practice is very well suited for measuring performance because you can measure above the practice and below the practice, and it's in line with the tile outlet. And so, you know, we did this for several years, and so we had some good baseline data, and we're feeding that data back to the farmer, feeding it back to Tim in this case. And so he was getting a picture of the condition of the water. And what Tim talks about publicly is that he thought that he was doing everything that was really he was being asked to do. You know, farmers, for the most part, believe they're implementing best management practices already. And it shouldn't be a big surprise that's the case because, you know, we've invested in research and extension and outreach of these technologies over the years. But when you start putting these combinations of practices and you measure the response downstream, I think Tim documented that he could change the nitrogen flow leaving his farm. And that's his message. And it's a really powerful message.
About how many farmers take advantage of the opportunity to test the water coming off their farm?
Well, you know, I'd say it's a small percentage right now. We're just, in the past year, we offered some tile monitoring analysis. NRCS just got really in the business of offering edge of field monitoring. So for the agency, it hasn't been a practice that they've really been invested in for a long time. And, you know, frankly, not everybody's sold on monitoring. We are because we think the data becomes pretty powerful. We think farmers make decisions based on data.
So a farmer can, through these programs, can do this for free?
It's free to them. It's subsidized by somebody else. We get grants from other nonprofits. The state provides some funding. The federal government, we've had a variety, like a conservation innovation grants through NRCS as an example. And then we manage the group called Agriculture's Clean Water Alliance, which is the group of ag retailers that are organized in the Des Moines, Raccoon, Boone River basins. And then as part of their work plan, they support an extensive water monitoring network. Part of the challenge with monitoring is that, you know, in Tim Smith's case, I think the tile only is on his farm. So in many cases, a tile might go across many fields. And so it's kind of hard to isolate what's actually impacting the tile water. We're trying to monitor the water to kind of document trends and help people measure performance and to help target investment of attention on these issues. A lot of the monitoring we've historically done in the Raccoon River Basin has really then led to targeted projects where then groups of farmers can organize themselves and get additional resources. And this is a big state, and there's no question that we have challenges, but this is how you do it. This is how you kind of methodically get at these issues that we're trying to improve. Everybody knows we have a new nutrient reduction strategy, and so a big part of this is giving the people that live out in the landscape some information and knowledge about the condition, and then going through some planning, you know, and then devoting the resources to implement that work. It's monitoring and assessment, planning, implementation, more monitoring and assessment to kind of determine, you know, impacts. You know, we're always trying to continuously improve on the situation. So that's the path we're on. And yes, it's very much farmer to farmer, a lot of alignment of organizations. And so we're working closely with the corn growers and the pork producers and, you know, trying to collectively make a difference.
Why wouldn't a regulatory approach work in your mind?
Well, I think everybody's fairly pragmatic about regulation. I think most people believe that there will be some regulation. I think the question is that if you are going to regulate, what would you regulate the people to do, and would it in fact have the outcome that you desire? And it's the truth of the matter is that because of the variability of the landscape and the weather, it's designing a prescriptive approach to solving these complex problems is really difficult.
And that was Roger Wolf of the Iowa Soybean Association. This is Greta Anderson of Local Talk, and I'm here with Jackie Comito. Jackie, any last thoughts about this question of regulatory versus mandatory approaches? We heard Roger talk about a methodical approach toward developing conservation systems on farmers' land. What do you think is going on?
Well, I wouldn't disagree what Roger said at the end. You know, I mean, regulation, exactly what is it going to look like? What are you going to regulate? It is a complex system. But I think from when I've listened to some of the environmental groups, what they're concerned about the whole nutrient reduction strategy is that there's no timeline associated with it. I mean, how slow of a process is this going to be? And I think their hope is that regulation will push some of these practices on the land faster. So I think there needs to be some kind of balance between knowing that it needs to be methodical and knowing that we really do need to get things. Because, you know, if you look at how much soil we've lost in the years, in the decades that we've been farming, and how much we have left, what's left? In some places, it's we've lost half of our topsoil. What's left becomes even more valuable, right? So if you had 30 inches and now you have 15, that last 15 is more valuable than that first 15 was, because that's all you got, and the earth takes a long time to make more soil. So I would say right now that people are feeling a sense of urgency about this that perhaps some of the people who are working in this area don't understand, that those of us who live in the state are feeling a sense of urgency. But it is going to take time, and regulation is not a magic bullet. It's not going to solve all the problems. In fact, we don't even know what it could look like. We've been looking at other places that have used regulation and actually used it successfully. So hopefully, when it does happen, it happens with the participation of farmers, so they have a voice in how it's going to happen. That's the best way to do it. It needs to be citizen driven in some ways if it's going to happen. And Roger's right. Some form of regulation. We use it all the time. Sometimes we call it regulation. Sometimes we call it the tax system. There are lots of ways to motivate people to do things differently. So, yeah, things do need to change. It's just a matter of how quickly will they change.
Okay. Well, those are the last words from Jackie Comito. And we are going to sample one of her tracks from her YouTube channel, the Water Rocks YouTube channel. This is a kind of crazy cover crop anthem. Heavy metal. Jackie, you're wearing leopard skin print, I believe.
Yep, I'm wearing leopard print. We've got somebody dressed up like a cover crop. We did it, I think this was in like early 80s heavy metal band.
Yeah, you're having way too much fun. You've been listening to Clean Water Radio, a special edition of Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, and I've been joined by special guest Jacqueline Comito, the co-manager of Iowa Learning Farms and the director of Water Rocks, an educational program that uses music to teach kids of all ages about water issues in the state. You can find all of Water Rocks' videos on their YouTube channel, and we'll be linking up to that show. And thank you very much, Jackie, for participating today.
Thank you for having me, Greta.
We also spoke with Tim Smith of Eagle Grove, Iowa, and Roger Wolf of the Iowa Soybean Association, located down in Ankeny. Richard Morrison engineered the show. Visit our website later in the day to find links to all our guests and a podcast of the show to share with your friends, farmers, and other clean water enthusiasts. KHOI is a radio production workshop as well as a show. We welcome your input. Come to our studio at 410 Douglas Street or give us a call at 292-2878. You can also contact us through our website. Again, that's khoifm.org. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.